Vopal Network is the bomb, the cutting edge of geekdom. Comics, advice, D&D, movies, video games, RPGs. Finding it easy, just stay calm. VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
Hey, this is John Shindahetti, Senior Creative Art Director of Dungeons & Dragons, and you got me here on The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 160. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to get artsy with an interview with John Shindahetti. And with me in this interview and this outro is Tracy Hurley.
Woo! Hello!
Don't sound so excited there, Tracy.
I'm excited.
Woo!
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, and actually, we're doing everything backwards today because we've already recorded the interview with John. And now we're doing our introduction. So you're in an upside-down, backwards world. And you're not going to hear this for probably 2 or 3 weeks after we release it. I decided to record this little sort of short episode with John, who is the Senior Creative Art Director at Wizards of the Coast. I think I said it wrong several times when we were talking to him. I kept forgetting the creative part. And he kept adding it back in every time he mentioned it. So I don't know. Did you notice that?
I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I suck.
I kind of felt bad because it happened like 2 or 3 times. I said senior creative or a senior art director, and then he kept correcting. I don't know that he was correcting me, but he kept following it up by saying senior creative art director. So, but no, he's an interesting guy who's been with Wizards of the Coast for some time now and is in charge of the look of D&D these days. So that's an interesting interview that we're going to go to here shortly. We're not going to share any Tome news because we're recording this several weeks in advance, and my plan is to have it edited and ready to go so it just automatically comes out as sort of your holiday special episode of the Tome Show. So everybody, feel festive and merry and bright. I know Tracy's in her sexy Santa outfit right now.
Exactly. Got to get those gifts going.
Good.
They have to get all wrapped up. The sleigh is waiting outside. Hot cocoa will be here when I return.
For a second there, I thought you said the slaves are waiting outside. Like, they were going to, after you're done recording, they're going to come in and wrap all the presents for you. Like, you're that kind of a Santa.
No. No, no, not at all. You have to pay them proper wages. And you know, they have to have freedom, because that's required.
Well, that's good. I recently heard a small child ask, you know, what are elves? And then when they heard the description, say, oh, so they're slaves. But I don't think that has to do with D&D. Let's go ahead and talk about our sponsor real quick, and then we'll get right into that interview. So our sponsor for this episode, as it has been for some time, is Noble Knight Games. Noble Knight Games is a brick-and-mortar store that also has a great online store, and they specialize in finding out-of-print products and finding them for you to be those little gems in your collection. But they also sell all the new products. To highlight some of that, I'm going to take two picks for this episode, one of which would be a great holiday gift that was mentioned during the interview. One of the products that John Shindahetti thinks he really put his stamp on, really, you know, shows what his art style is about, is the new Gamma World 4th Edition box set. And I'm going to let Tracy talk a little bit about that, because I believe you've played 4th Edition Gamma World. Is that true?
I played one game, yes.
How did that go?
It went pretty well. I really like it. I like just having, it's about having fun. And there's nothing better in the world than just sitting down, rolling up a random character, not so much caring about whether or not they die, because they probably will, but just that they go out with that big bang, and I really like that.
So, yeah, and I hesitated and hesitated and hesitated, and I finally just this week ordered my Gamer World box set, and it just came today, and it looks pretty cool. I'm looking forward to digging into it. It sounds like it's not something you necessarily want to pick up for a grand campaign, but works really well for short, you know, one or two shot games. Does that sound accurate?
I think so, yeah. Some people are running campaigns, but I think it's more for a shorter time, yeah.
That seems to be the appeal for me anyway. And at Noble Knight, it's only about $32. It's actually a little bit under $32. So if you get a handful of good one-shot games out of it and have a blast with it, then I think you got your money's worth. To go along with that pick, though, I also wanted to mention another Noble Knight pick. Shortly, actually, depending on where you're at, if you're going to your local game store or shopping elsewhere, the first module, the sort of expansion for the 4th edition Gamer World has been released, called Famine in Fargo. And looking around on Noble Knight, I found the original Famine in Fargo, originally published in 1982, a whole 32-page booklet adventure that came out for the original, I assume the original Gamer World. I was 3 when this book was published, so I think it might be some interesting sort of source material. Go back and find out what was the old Gamma World like, and maybe steal some of the crazy, kooky adventure ideas out of the old Famine in Fargo, which sells for $18 at Noble Knight, long out of print, but available in multiple versions from them, or different... What's the... what am I trying to say? Conditions. Some conditions might be better than others, so... and that's Noble Knight. Find links to them in the show notes. And when we come back, we're going to jump right into the interview with John and Tracy and myself.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Okay, I am here with Tracy Hurley and John Shindahedi. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
All right, I won. I win the interview. I pronounced your name correctly. and John is the senior art director for Dungeons & Dragons at Wizards of the Coast, which gives us a unique insight into the world of D&D that some people don't often get to hear about. So I'm looking forward to chatting with you today, John. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tracy, why don't you start us off?
Okay, so I have a really hard question. How did you start playing D&D?
That is a hard question because I have to think back a really long way. Actually started back in the late 70s, so that gives you an idea how long it is. I almost said at my age, that's difficult. I don't want to say that, though. But I had a few friends who convinced me to play D&D back in high school. Just because they were able to convince the high school to give us a room at lunch. We could go in there and play in the afternoons. And, you know, I was a little hesitant to play at first, but I got in there, played the first session. I've been a fan for life ever since.
That sounds great. And similar stories, usually it sounds like middle school, high school friends tend to, and sometimes siblings tend to be the common way to get into the game. So let's really stretch your memory here. Do you remember your first character?
I do remember my first character, and of course I remember it the most because it was the lamest, shortest lifespan of a character ever known to mankind. Rolled up a little wizard, we got into battle, we were in battle about 20 minutes, and I lost a hand due to one of those lovely little critical hit tables that they had way back then, And, you know, a wizard without hands is not very much good, so I threw myself off the wall and decided that I'd never be a magic user again. And even to this day, I refuse to play magic users. I only play the big, burly melee guys, and my current character is a big Goliath warden that's built to do nothing but hit hard and fast and not get his hands chopped off.
So it scarred you for life, huh?
For life. It's. I frown every time I think of playing a magic user.
Does that affect your art at all? Do you avoid drawing wizards now, too?
No, not at all. I just make sure that they're really badass wizards so they don't lose their hand 5 minutes into a game.
Okay, good.
Probably a good tip. Okay, so talking about the artwork, how did you end up at Wizards of the Coast?
Kind of roundabout way. I was working at an agency down in Texas, outside of Dallas, back in the 90s, and I was pointed towards an ad for an online/web art director at the time. And it was from this little game company I'd never heard of. I did some research, found out that they were a card company that was supposed to be quite popular, though I'd never heard of it, because for me, cards had involved betting, and that was about it. Did some more research and found out this little game company was acquiring a game company I felt I was in love with, which was TSR. So I decided, hey, you know, if they're good enough to buy TSR, they're good enough for me to work for. So I fired off to the ad, made a few phone calls, pulled in some favors, got an interview. Fast forward a couple of months, and I ended up sitting in orientation class with all my peers, geek fantasies, I guess, whatever you want to call it, you know, sitting in orientation class with Brom and Todd Lockwood and Jeff Easley and these guys, and just, you know, totally having a geek fest while I was sitting here going through orientation here at Wizards of the Coast.
Wow.
So that was how I got started up there.
So you started off working on magic then?
Actually, I started off working just with as the website art director. So I worked on all brands. It was just anything that had to do with the website at the time. After I worked there, I transferred over to working with the marketing team. And I primarily started working with Dungeons & Dragons at that point. And then it's been primarily Dungeons & Dragons ever since then.
Okay, and from then it was just a slow build up the ladder to becoming the senior art director?
Well, actually it was a fast build up the ladder all the way up to VP of the creative group. And then I stepped off that ladder and went down to art director for the digital side of games, and then walked back up to where I'm at now, which is the senior creative art director.
So what's your background that got you into all this?
Well, my background, actually, I got into the creative arts as a photographer way back in the 70s, and did photography, graphic design, sculpture, pottery, illustration, kind of ran the gamut in the 80s and 90s, when the internet was starting to come on big. I decided to go back to school, got a degree in multimedia, web design, 3D animation, that type of stuff. And then that's how I got into the electronic side of things. And so all those different disciplines that I've gotten is what kind of led to me where I'm at right now, which is, you know, having a position where I oversee lots of different aspects of the process.
So let's go ahead and talk about what that is that, you know, you went through all those different paths and eventually ended up as the senior art director. What does that mean? What does the senior art director do? What's a day in the life of John Shindahedi look like?
You like to ask tough questions, don't you? all right, so my title is senior creative art director, and that's kind of a mouthful all in itself, but in a nutshell, I'm responsible for the visual aspect of the brand, and that's every aspect of it, from the RPGs, the magazines, the comics, the novels, the website, the video games, the media, you know, blah, 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 blah. If it has a picture on it and it has the D&D logo associated with it, I'm responsible for overseeing it. Luckily, I have this very talented and creative creative studio that I work with, my art directors and graphic designers, and so they're actually the real heroes of the day. They make everything happen and do it really, really well. But for myself, my common day, what's a day? there's no real common day. They're all pretty extraordinary for the most part. I start out early. I'm usually up by 5 o'clock in the morning. I'll go work out, or I'll do a post on my blog, which is Art Order artorder.blogspot.com. It's written primarily for the fantasy and sci-fi illustration community. I have a lot of fun doing that. So that's my morning start. Once I get to work about 7:30, that's when my day starts. We start off with a stand-up meeting with the creative group, or with our creative studio, and we go through, we look at all the art that's come in, and we do crits on it, and talk about the artist, who's hot, who's not. We don't like to talk about that, though. We talk about which projects, look at designs, talk about what we've got going on, and a million other things. And then that's really when our day kind of starts. And at that point, then I'll go to production meetings and strategy brand strategy meetings, do a little bit of design, commission some art, talk with some external vendors or licensors, work with the studios trying to keep projects on track, you know, kind of everything you can think of that I might have to do, I have to do. And basically, I try and fit all that into a 10 or 12-hour day.
So, and you said that involves not only the website and the books and the boxes and the novels, but that's also the comics and other licensed products and all that kind of stuff too?
Yep, everything.
So you cover a lot of bases. And so you just sort of, it sounds like you sort of act like the almost the liaison between everybody else and the art department.
In a lot of ways, that is true. That's in a lot of ways, that is what my job is. So I, combination of liaison, I'm the guy who sets the standard for what the visual looks going to be. So I'm the guy who builds the style guides and says, this is what the Bible is. And then the rest of my creative studio, they're the guys who sit here and help enforce it and then, you know, and do a lot of the very tactical day-to-day operations as well.
Okay. So I think one thing a lot of people are curious about is just the process that's used to determine what kind of art ends up in the D&D products and how it looks. Can you talk about that a little bit?
The process is pretty simple. Well, it's really not that simple. It's kind of complex, actually, anytime you get into it. The thing that starts out, R&D, as part of their design and development aspect of it, they define how big the book's going to be, what all is going to be in it, what's all the subject matter going to be. Part of that process is then also saying, you know, I'm going to need art to illustrate these concepts or these ideas or these characters or these races, you know, anything where they think there's a visual need, they identify that to us. And they'll write up a document that identifies all the different pieces that they'll need and what the concepts are that they're trying to capture. And then what I'll do at that point is I sit down with the art director and we go through it, make sure we understand everything that's being asked for, ask lots of questions. I bring with it the knowledge of what the brand managers and the product owners are trying to have this product do. So we make sure that everything fits within, all the art fits within those constraints that the business folks have set in place. And then we'll sort through all that. Yeah, and then after that, once we figured it all out, then we break it out by what's, you know, how much money do we have and how many art pieces we're going to do and try and find artists to make it all work and flow and make sure that we get the artists that work best for the content that we're trying to fill out and get all commissioned and start going from that point. And then we just go through the whole process of reviewing and evaluating and make sure the art's up to the snuff that we're trying to get it to do, make sure it's getting across the concept of what the art is supposed to be illustrating. And then, it, you know, it's just a production process at that point.
Okay. So you talked about, you know, dealing with costs and finding the right art for the look and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things I've heard on a few occasions since the launch of 4th edition is why are we recycling old art? Why are we taking 3rd edition art and putting it – or art from 3rd edition products and putting it into 4th edition books? And could you explain that that reasoning a little bit, why that, how that kind of thing happens?
Yeah, I can. It's not an answer anybody ever likes to hear. It also comes down to just a matter of budget, you know. We say we're going to build this book, we're going to create this book, it's got to have, you know, our consumers are only willing to pay X amount of dollars for it, so we've only got X amount of dollars I can spend on it. And that basically comes down to, John, you have X amount of dollars you can spend on art for it. So when we were going through this whole process I was talking about earlier of R&D defining all the art needs for the book. After we've gotten all that worked out and decided how many pieces of art we need, what sizes we need, we compare that to what our budget is. When I'm really, really happy is when I have an art budget to cover all the art needs. When I'm not so happy is when I have an art budget that doesn't meet all the art needs. And at that point, I'm trying to decide, do we have art available that we've done in the past that we can pick up that illustrates exactly what these guys are trying to get us to use, and can we use that? And so, you know, a lot of it's just a matter of trying to juggle the needs of the book as R&D defines it versus the needs of the budget for, you know, that our business folks define it, and trying to keep it as high a quality as I can for the consumers, because, you know, like them, I'm also a big fan, and I hate looking at something that I've already seen once before myself too. So I completely understand when they groan at me about it, because I groan sometimes too about it.
Okay. Oh, and you mentioned also that you need to match up, like, the right type of artist with the type of art you're trying to get for the book. Do you also try to get new artists in, and how do you find new artists when you do?
Yeah, we're always trying to find new artists. My ultimate goal when I'm working with artists is to get artists that I can help grow and mentor and nurture to the point where they're so big that they can't work for me anymore. So I'm always trying to find artists to replace those guys who've gone off to be rock stars, to work for, you know, Magic the Gathering or some other, you know, like Tony DiDelizzi, who goes off and creates his children's books and his films. And, you know, obviously I can't afford to work with him anymore. And that's a great thing because they're being successful. So yeah, I'm always looking for new artists. I go to a lot of conventions and events where I do portfolio reviews and workshops and roundtables. I visit schools when I'm invited and do reviews and lectures. I find artists' websites through Concept Art and CG Hub. Then I also get portfolio submissions through our submissions process. And folks can just send portfolio samples to artdrop@wizards.com. You can keep that in your little Rolodex and send me stuff. And then I also find a ton of artists through my art order blog and its associated community. So I usually see anywhere between 1,000, 1,500 artists a year. And from that, we try and find, you know, 20 to 30 new artists each year to sit here and bring into the fold and start mentoring and growing to replace artists as they leave.
So it sounds like a lot of it is just you try to stay active in the community yourself and be familiar with people that are out there?
Very much, very much. I enjoy it. That's, you know, it's one of the joys I have in life is working with the other artists. One of my greatest joys is acting as a mentor and helping folks who have an aspiration to be a professional freelance illustrator, you know. And so I try and give back to them, you know, the stuff that was given to me all these years and all the folks who helped me out and gave me the nurturing and the experience that they had gleaned. So I just try and give it back to the community whenever possible.
Sure. So one of the things that has to go along with art, I imagine, is various layout choices, graphic design and all that kind of stuff. And one of the questions, I put out a call on Twitter the other night when I knew when we were going to be talking and all that, to say, what kind of questions would you guys want to know? And one of the questions that came out that dealt with layout a little bit was, how do you make some of those decisions, like when to include captions, when not to include captions, when to do, you know, the crazy art where it's, you know, a dimension door that starts on one page and ends on another page, or, you know, stuff like that. How do we make those layout decisions that appear in the different books?
Tracy's laughing. I can hear her in the background. A lot of that stuff is, first of all, let me start off with the easy answer. The easy answer is a lot of our stuff is templated. We decide at the beginning of fourth edition, we sat down and decided, here's the types of books that we generally do, and we built templates for most of them. So that the reason we do that is because we want folks who are reading the books to be able to pick it up and understand exactly what they're reading and know where the information will go and how the information will be displayed. So we want to make sure that that's as consistent as possible so that we don't have a lot of confusion. Outside of that, our choices, sometimes are happy circumstances, sometimes there's things that are planned. It really depends. I mean, a lot of times it depends on what the book is. I mean, one of the things when we were doing the player strategy book that came out had a very different style, very different look. Part of that was a very decided decision at the beginning was We wanted to make a book that was very friendly, very approachable, had a very lighthearted, you know, informal conversation feel, and both through the text and with the images. So there was a conscious decision there. Sometimes things just happen when we commission giant ants for the monster manual, and the artist sends back a whole bunch of ants, and we go, hey, that's really cool. We can use them and put a couple ants over here on the page and a couple ants over here on the page. And so those are just happy little circumstances that just pop up and we run with them. Mm-hmm. And as far as captions go, that's a function of R&D. They decide what things need to be captioned or not.
Okay.
Talking about R&D, I think you mentioned before that R&D sends over their information, what type of artwork they want. That mm-hmm. one is typically called the art orders.
Art order, art description, yeah. We or art suggestion, it goes by a million different names. For us, we term it the final that we send off to the artist. We either call it an art description or an art order.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just going through this process now, so I'm learning a lot of it as I go. So yeah. How much freedom in general does the artist have when they get them? Or do the R&D people give very specific details? And just in general, who gets to say what gets into the art?
Yeah, that's kind of a fun little balancing act that's often happens. I mean, the goal that I always take when I'm working up the art orders is I want to give enough information so that the artist knows exactly what's expected of them. But at the same point, I don't want to give so much information that I suck all the creativity out of the process. So there are times when I say, you know, if I'm just describing a specific character, we have to give a lot of information. We'll have to talk about what color hair they have, what clothes they might be wearing, if they have a specific item they have on them, if they're using a specific named weapon, we have to describe that. But there's other times where I say, I have a elf fighter battling a blah, 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 and that's as simple as it gets. So a lot depends on what the content of the image is, how much we have to detail it out, or how much freedom we're allowed to give.
So how many people, to follow up on that, how many people get a say in the artwork that comes out? I mean, is it basically the R&D, the author, and you, and the artist? Or, is there a marketing person or, somebody from higher up in Wizards or Hasbro who gets a look at these things?
Yeah. Now, we keep it pretty simple for the most part. There's myself and Chris Perkins, who is the analog to me on the R&D side. The two of us are anytime the art comes in, we review all the art that comes through the process. We get to have the final say. Chris makes the final say on anything that's gameplay related, and I get to have the final say on anything that's just pure art related. And things that kind of fall in that gray area, we arm wrestle about, and sometimes he wins and sometimes I win. But that's the extent of it.
Okay, so there's no interaction from higher up that says, no, you can't do that or anything like that?
No, the only time we ever get anything like that is occasionally we might push the line a little bit, and so we might see it and step in, but 99.9% of the time, it's just Chris and I, and it stays right there.
Okay.
Thankfully, we don't have any committees.
Do you have an example of something that might be in that gray area?
Something that might be in that gray area. Oh, for example, R&D might give me a suggestion that says, hey, we want this big Goliath fighter, a big Goliath warden, and he's using this type of weapon. And as we're looking at it, we might say, you know, given the monster he's fighting or given the circumstances he's in and the fact that we've used that weapon and that shield and that armor 17 other times in this book, we think it's overdone, so we'd like to use this other weapon. Now, R&D called for that. Artistically, we're asking for something different. That's something that falls into that gray area, and then they finally have to make the decision of, is this something that's absolutely required because of play reasons, or is it just a wish by, you know, somebody in R&D saying, we think that's a really cool weapon, in which case that's that gray area. You have to delineate and find out where it actually falls so that we can make a call.
Right.
And if you were to arm wrestle, do you or Chris usually win? Who's stronger? Who works out more?
Well, I think he works out more, but I cheat really good.
Oh, okay. Good. So, go ahead, Tracy.
I was just going to say, can we film these arm wrestling contests and put them online? I think you'd get a lot of viewers.
Yeah, no, I don't think I want to do that because I don't want to be humiliated.
Good. So it's you've been with D&D and the brand working in the look of everything for some time now. Could you speak a little bit about the look of 4th edition? Because, you know, other editions, you know, 3rd edition especially had a really specific look. You know,
yeah.
I can look at my shelf and in an instant say, there's my 3rd edition books. And
yep.
I'm curious, when you transition over to 4th edition, what kind of the look, what was that process like, or what is that look that you aim for 4th edition?
So, 3rd edition, Don Mirren did an amazing job with 3rd edition in setting up that whole tome look. It was wonderful and beautiful and rich. And the decision was made when we were shifting over to 4th edition, and Tracy or Stacy Longstreet was the art director at the time for that switchover, and the decision was made that they wanted to decidedly take a step away from that rich tome look and go to something that was a little more clean and, dare I say, even textbook-like in its layout and its presentation, and so have a very different look to it. And so that was the guiding line, or the guidelines that was set forth for us as we were starting to do creative iterations on the process and trying to figure out ways to present these products in such a manner that would differentiate them for the 3rd edition, but at the same time fall into the D&D fantasy realm. So, yeah, it was a struggle, and like I said, I wasn't part of that. I was in a different division at the time, in the gaming division, and I know there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of long, late discussions about it, and where they ended up is where they ended up, and we've just tried to stay faithful to that original brand decision and keep it rolling forward and keep it consistent.
And so there are changes with 4th edition. Were there also changes with the digital initiative on the process of doing art for D&D?
Yeah, it actually did make a lot of changes to the process. And, you know, it used to be really simple in the sense that the authors would write the book, editors would edit the book, we would lay out the book, the production crew would get the book printed. That used to be nice, simple. It still had its own levels of chaos, but it was nice and simple for the most part. And now we have to do a lot more to it. So now we have to shuffle content over to the digital team for integration into the DDI tools. We got to send texts and images over to the folks to use on the website, bits and pieces over to the contact folks to use for daily web postings, more bits over to the PR and marketing folks for use in the PR events and social media blasts, and on and on and on and on. You know, and so what we had to do is develop a lot more pipelines and a lot more efficiencies and a lot more tie-ins into the process, so that as things are being created, we're siphoning off bits of information to all these different departments and all these different folks who have to use this content in a million different ways. So it becomes quite an interesting event when in dealing with the logistics of all the text and images have to go to all these different places.
Sure.
Is your turnaround time faster then because of the need for the constant online content, or is it still about the same?
It's about the same, and sometimes it's even a little bit longer. There's an interesting fallacy that folks often have. They think that because you don't have to print it, it's faster. Sometimes that's true, sometimes it's not so true, because you still have all the delivery mechanisms we still have to put into place of how do I, you know, okay, so I finished creating it all, now I have to deliver it to all these different aspects. So it often still takes about the same amount of time as sending it off to get it printed.
Yeah, I just wasn't sure if there was like this pressure to create things quicker because we want to get a new post up or something like that.
But no, there's always a pressure to create things quicker. I mean, we're always trying to find ways to get to the market faster because when you can be mobile and react to the wants and needs of the industry, so that, you know, if your fans are saying, hey, we really want this, and you've got a 3-year turnaround cycle, so that you know, it takes 3 years for them to start to see changes, that's just too long, you know. So we try and get things closer to, much closer to, you know, real time as much as possible. But, you know, until the day we can say, I'm typing on my computer today and blasting it out 20 minutes later doing, you know, daily blog posts, it's always going to be a matter of, we got to get authors to write this stuff and get it laid out and get it edited and get it into the workflow. So we're always trying to find ways to make it faster and more efficient, but it's still not instant yet, darn it.
Sure. You mentioned earlier some of the names of the people who preceded you and, you know, created the look of third edition and that kind of thing. I'm curious, you know, what's your stamp that we can see on D&D's look today? You know, where can we look and say, oh, that's something that John did, that some, you know, what's your big contribution?
What's my big contribution? Wow. I wish I really had one. I guess my biggest contribution would be looking at some of the newest artists that I've brought into the fold. Folks like Tyler Jacobson, who's a hot young artist who I was shown by Irene Gallo when she visited him in school in San Francisco, and he's just taken off and taken the world by storm. So it's folks like that, that's the stamp you'll see from me. Other than that, it's stuff that you'll be seeing in the future that I can't talk about yet, because, like we said, things aren't instant yet. But, you know, over the course of the next year, 2 years, there's going to be a lot more things that will have the stamp of Joe and Shindahedi on it, for better or for worse, hopefully for better. And that's always the case with us, is, you know, we work on things now, and by the time we've forgotten about them, you guys are just starting to see them. And people are saying, hey, wow. Gamma World would probably be another one. I was given a directive to make the new Gamma World game something fun and bold and a little bit in your face, and that was kind of the direction we went, a little more comic style, a little more tongue-in-cheek, serious, but with a little bit of a lightheartedness to it, and I love that game. I love playing that game, and I look forward to playing it every time I get a chance. The new board games, Castle Ravenloft, and a couple others that are going to be coming out. Those are all have my stamp on them as well, too. And the creative studio that I've built. That'd be about it at the moment. Comic books that are just coming out, working with Denton Tipton. So, good stuff.
Very cool. It sounds like the art department is more and more involved as things move forward. One of the big things that's happened in the D&D brand just the last half of this year is the Essentials line. And I'm curious, you know, we talked about the look of 4th edition, but the look of Essentials is decidedly different than that. Could you speak to that that look a little bit?
Yeah, that was a fun line to work on too, because the big step there was When the brand team and Bill Slavicek came to me on that one, they said they wanted to create a new line that was D&D, but they wanted it to have a slightly different look to it. Still kind of kept with some of the sensibilities of 4th edition, but at the same time felt a little more approachable, a little more friendly, because they were going to be building this line of Essentials products that were to be a group of 10 products that sat on the bookshelves forever and ever and ever. You know, that's... And gave a real easy entry point for a new person who walked in the store and said, where do I start? Because the biggest things that we found is that our entrenched player walked in and said, oh, hey, there's a new book. Great, I got to pick it up. I'm going to go, you know, go home, read it, whatever. But the new folks who walked in and looked at this rack of books and said, where the heck do I start? And that was the whole line of the Essentials, was we wanted to have a look that differentiated itself enough that it stood out on the shelves from the rest of the D&D books, said, hey, I'm fresh, I'm young, I'm a little more approachable, and that folks would grab onto it and know that if they wanted to buy into it, this was the selection of stuff they could buy into, and then if they wanted to go and get more franchised, the rest of the D&D core lookbooks were there for them to move on into that.
So a quick follow-up to that. Within the Essentials line is the Red Box, which... This looks decidedly different than the rest of the Essentials line, even going back to the old school art. Can you talk a little bit about the decision to use the older art on a product intended to bring in new players?
So the idea of the Red Box, the role-playing starter game, was actually less about trying to bring in new players and more about trying to grab the guys who were from my days back in the 70s and 80s who were playing for a long time but dropped out because kids, college, wives, life, you know, jobs. But now they've started hit a point in their life where they're looking to get back to that, looking to capture some of that fun from their youth again. And so that was the product that was actually aimed at them to sit here and say, hey, remember back in the 70s and 80s when you were playing and you had so much fun and you remembered this red box? Well, here's your new access. Here's the way to get back into the game and bag, you know, and buy back into it. And so that was really what it was there for. And that was the whole reason we went with that look and you know, and working with Larry and using his new piece and then, you know, getting some of the homage pieces on the inside was because we wanted to sit here and be attracted to those guys and then say, hey, and while you're here, here's this easy to start and have, you know, set of products right here with the essentials and pointing them towards essentials saying you can get back into here. So it was a little bit of two different purposes with the red box.
Okay, good. I think that's the first time I've heard that explanation before, so that's good to know.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I could give a new explanation.
Thanks.
So we talked a lot about the art, but I was also wondering, are you in charge of maps for the different products and getting them done?
Yes, maps fall into our little purview as well.
Do you have any tips for drawing maps?
Do them really well. No, the biggest thing about maps are, you know, maps are two things. First of all, they're a game aid. You know, so they're for the dungeon master to use to describe a room, to show, you know, where things are located in a room. So from that aspect, the game has got to be completely the map's got to be very understandable, easy to read, and fast and easy to use. From the art side of it, then we start talking about, you know, how are things depicted? You know, Jason Engels does a lot of our great big giant poster maps, and we do a set style for a lot of that, the big poster maps and the dungeon tile maps. But when we start doing the more illustrative maps, we've got a number of guys who just do really wonderful illustrative maps, nice cartography. And so those are a fine mix. Those are a fun mix between, you know, kind of a fine art style and being very useful for the player and for the DM as well, too. And so what I always recommend to folks when they want to say, ask, you know, what's the best way to learn how to do good maps, I always tell them, go back and look at the old cartography maps, you know, turn of the century stuff that was used by the captains, and start looking at how they use symbology and cartography to illustrate not just a space, but also to tell a story. And I think that's where the maps, really good maps, really come into play, is when they can not just describe a space, but start to tell a story as well.
Now, you mentioned maps and dungeon tiles and that kind of stuff. Is there, and this has come up in conversations I've had recently, is there ever some effort or pressure when you're making maps for, you know, an adventure or whatever, to make sure that a person could build that map with the dungeon tiles, to use those components and that kind of thing?
I know that's something that definitely comes into play occasionally. It's not, we don't want to limit the authors of adventures to say you can only build adventures that can use dungeon tiles. But we do try and ask them to keep those in mind, that when they're developing these adventures, that whenever possible, people can use dungeon tiles, because there's a lot of folks who like to use the dungeon tiles. And so, you know, it's kind of a pain if we create maps that use a 50 by 50 room and we don't have dungeon tiles that would match that big cartography mat and start hand drawing their maps, which I still do personally. But, you know, there's a lot of folks who've migrated away from that. So we keep it in mind. We don't limit it. We don't say it's an absolute necessity. You'll see a lot of the magazines, we actually do use dungeon tile maps for a lot of our adventures, just because we've received a lot of input from folks that is something they like to see, is they like to be able to use their dungeon tiles to lay out the maps for those adventures. Some folks do, some folks don't, and that's why we don't limit it.
Okay, great. Well, I think we're getting ready to wrap this up. We've taken a bit of your time here. So I wanted to say thanks for joining us and just ask, is there anything else that you would like to tell the listeners out there?
Not at the moment. We got a lot of great things coming out in the next year. Keep your eyes peeled and keep bouncing back to the website and see what's going on. There'll be a lot of great announcements in the coming months that I wish I could talk about, but they just didn't give me a release to do it. And just, you know, you can always contact me. I'm on Facebook and I'm on, like I said, on artorder.blogspot.com. Hop on there if any of your listeners have questions or comments or want to rail at me and send me hate mail. They can just fire it on over. I'm used to it. And if they want to send me glowing, happy reports, I'm used to getting those as well, too. So I like to be as approachable as possible.
Great, thanks. And thanks for all the tips.
Oh, my pleasure. This was great. Thank you.
All right, so that was myself and Tracy interviewing John Shendahetti, the Senior Creative Art Director of D&D, of the D&D brand. Tracy, what was the most interesting thing you heard there? What was your favorite part?
I liked all the tips, I liked hearing about how the process works and how closely he works with Chris Perkins and the arm wrestling that goes on.
Yeah, I was actually, I don't know, I found a lot of it to be a very sort of, he seemed very open and very transparent and very willing to say, look, sometimes we make these decisions because it's the decision we have to make for budgetary reasons, or, you know, this is the audience we were looking for this person. And I thought John was a really straight shooter with us, and I appreciated that, because that's not always what you get when you're depending on who you're talking to, you know? Some people like to be a little more guarded, but I found him to be a real straight shooter, so I'll have him back any day.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that part of the conversation as well, because like you said, too often they gloss over the fact that, hey, it's a business. As much as we love D&D and as much as it's our hobby, you know, at the end of the day, they have budgets they have to meet and everything.
Right. So I guess we're going to call that episode 160. If people want to get a hold of me, they can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com, visit the forums at gamershavenpodcast.com, or call the Tomes Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME with your thoughts, questions, or comments for any upcoming episodes, the latest D&D news, or whatever products are coming out that you want to talk about. And I want to thank Tracy for joining us. Tracy, where can people go to follow you around on the internet? How can we stalk you?
You can stalk me at SarahDarkMagic.com or on Twitter as SarahDarkMagic. And then I also have another podcast called 4Geeks4E and a few other things, but those are the main ones. You'll find me.
She's not hard to find, and if you follow her on Twitter, she's pretty quick to promote anything that she's got going on. So you'll find her all of her various little corners of the internet pretty quickly that way.
My empire.
Your empire. That's right. You're slowly taking over the interweb. And I want to remind people to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds. That helps keep us on the air and helps pay some of the various expenses that we have here. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 158. I need a witty ending.
Dragon has been drawn.
You know what? We need a witty ending, I think, is going to be our witty ending. And this has been our interview with John Shendahetti, Senior Creative Art Director for the D&D brand at Wizards of the Coast of
The Toe. I'm on the wall.